You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Your letters coming up a bit later. Now, memoirist and poet Gregory Pardlow. Just a few chapters into this new memoir, you realize what an unreliable narrator Gregory Pardlow's father was and how a childhood is shaped when a parent can't always be believed. Big Greg's stories were forged from self-aggrandizement, narcissism, and drama. He was a passionate man, Mr. Pardlow writes. My father's world operated on homespun destiny, the kind of destiny that was dictated by character and the inevitability of Hollywood endings. I'm talking about the power you have to shape the story. That story didn't unfold the way Big Greg imagined. When he was fired in 1981 during the air traffic controller strike, everything changed about the identity of this family. And that's where I thought, as our conversation develops, you might have some insight to add. Did you grow up in a household where lightning struck in some fundamental way? A parent's loss of a job, a diagnosis of a serious mental illness, a parent who went to prison? I'm interested in how that reshaped the identity of your family. Think about that. Join the discussion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Again, as our discussion begins, I'd like you to think about your own experience of who your family was and whether there was a big traumatic change and how that reshaped the idea of who your family was. 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Gregory Pardlow is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and the author of the new memoir, Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. And he joins us today from New York City. And Gregory, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Hi, Carrie. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You know, when I suggested in the introduction that your father was an unreliable narrator, I don't want our listeners to think that these were just misstatements of fact. It was really your father's view of who he was and who you were, and a worldview that in some ways was pretty distorted. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, I guess I hesitate, or I hedge rather, because I think we all have stories that we tell ourselves about who we are and how we're supposed to conduct ourselves in life and what we will allow ourselves to aspire to. And my father's self-image, it turned out, having hit run over the cliff of the 1981 air traffic controller strike, his story had to change radically, and he was so convinced of the solidness of that story, the reliability of that story, that he had a hard time adjusting to and coming up with a new self-image. So I think there was a necessary fudging on his part, necessary, you know, fibbing and nipping and tucking the story to kind of make it fit his. Maintain his self-image.
I mean, it does sound like you're saying, Gregory, it was a survival technique.
Survival technique,
that makes a lot of sense. But you do say, I think early on in the memoir, that you catch yourself even today slipping into that worldview. You say so much of the way I interpret the world has come from the way he interprets it. When do you catch yourself, acknowledging that?
Well, when I feel myself thinking, this is exactly how I know how this situation is supposed to go, you know. So if I'm in an interaction that we've seen on television or we've seen in movies, I'm supposed to fill X role in this situation, and I find myself kind of playing into the expectations of some narrative that I'm really not interested in playing. Participating in. And part of what I'm doing in this book is trying to dig through, as like an archaeologist, I'm digging through layers of stories that I've told myself, that I've been convinced not only by by my father, but by society and, you know, just the people around me I love, in fact. And I find that the deepest stories, the most fundamental stories are those that my parents have, and I think this is probably true for everybody, right? The stories that my parents raised me with. And you know, they don't always still apply. They don't always still serve. They don't continue to serve in the way that they did in childhood.
And, yeah. Do you remember, I think that's always a part, right, of the rite of passage from moving from childhood into adulthood, right? Testing the story of the family and the story mm-hmm. that your parents believe about themselves and believe about you, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's pretty mm-hmm. important, too. Do you remember the first or second time you began to think there might be a different story than the one my parents are telling me about what this is?
Yeah, well, dropping out of college was the first one. So as a very young kid, I remember distinctly my parents investing in treasury bonds. And we would sit and they would show me the treasury bonds. This is going to be the money that's going to put you through college. And then after the strike, we were, you know, they were scrambling to keep the household afloat. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, those treasury bonds disappeared, you know, they necessarily. But they never told me that that nest egg was gone. So I go off to college thinking my story is still reliable. You know, this is how this is supposed to go. And yeah, the bills just weren't being paid. And I was, my self-image, my self-confidence, you know, self-esteem, all of that was really shaken to the core. And I found myself having to adjust, having to, you know, adapt to a set of circumstances I hadn't foreseen or planned on.
You know, it's interesting that story focuses around education because you write, this is just fascinating. You write at length about your father's ambivalence about the idea of being educated. It's complicated because he had difficulty with the idea of if you were a student, it meant you had something to learn and you were succumbing in some ways to someone else's authority. But I do get the sense he respected education.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's so fascinating to me that you know, I'm not sure if it's simply contradictory or hypocritical, but it is, you know, sort of paradoxical in an interesting way. He absolutely admired intelligence and wit. And worldly knowledge, but I think he preferred and admired people who seemed to come by it naturally through observation and right and just sort of kind of self-awareness. And yeah, the relationship between teacher and student was a subordinate relationship that he refused to submit to.
You know, in some ways, you know, as I listened to you describe that, I thought, I think we're also a culture in some ways that admires, you know, what we think of as street smarts or that gut instinct more than maybe we're a little more cynical or suspicious about that kind of awareness that comes through education. Mm-hmm. I wonder why that is.
Yeah, well, I do think I kind of bristle myself at the charges that Americans are anti-intellectual, you know, like and on a whole. And I think there is something to that. But what that is we and this is obviously a massive generalization, but I think we are distrustful of the kind of dogmatic training, the kind of socialization that a classroom education entails. Right. And there's something kind of romantic about the self-educated, the as you say, the street smart, unfortunately, man is the image that that comes to mind. Right.
Yeah. And yet, though, I mean, I've had this debate when we've talked about higher education on this show, and the cost of it and the value of it and all that. But, you know, I believe that really higher education is all about all those other qualities that I think your dad admired and that you've just acknowledged. It's really about self-awareness, right? Memorization of dates and places and then learning how to critically think through that is really important. But the thing that's happening, right, is you're growing self-awareness and where you fit.
Yeah, well, so that's another thing that I explore in the book is as a university professor myself, I do find that there is a kind of commodification of the college degree or you know, a sort of customer relationship, customer way of thinking about, you know, I'm paying you, teacher, to give me the product that is a high school diploma, a college degree. And so I do find that there is a less of an awareness of how liberating it can be to learn how to think, to practice think critical thinking, and how much it can serve one's sense of self.
Right.
In all situations.
And should, what if your dad was part of this conversation, what would he say to that, to what you just said? Would he believe that?
I think he would, but he would be really cynical about it. He would, I think he would dismiss it as, well, that's not how the game is played. Yes, Greg Jr., I admire your idealism and, you know, good, he would pat me on the head sort of, you know, symbolically. But he would say, well, you look at the people who are successful.
as you just described that, I thought that really rings true in the portrait that you've created here, that your dad often assumed a naivete on the part, not just of you, but on the part of, I think, people that he encountered through the day. And he was the guy that had the inside knowledge. Yes?
That's right. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And so I describe an interaction he had with a neighbor who, you know, they were young parents, and the neighbor was a graduate student at Temple at the time.
Right.
And my father was so just sort of not only dismissive, but really condescending. You know, it was almost a sign of weakness that one would spend so long studying, you know, and when the world is all around you. And yeah, he saw it as a kind of dilettantism, I guess.
You know, you can never, I want to say, win with people like that.
Because they're
always convinced they know just that much more than you do, and your naivete is showing. Because if it wasn't, you'd know what they know.
What they know, right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and, you know, when I was very young, this was something I admired in my father. This was one of the things that made him reliable. One of the things that at least I could rely on in him was that he was always right. as wrong as wrong could be, his performance of himself, his self-awareness was always in the right. And as long as I aligned myself with him, I would be protected by that sort of dogged determinism. But, you know, as we're saying, the older I got, you know, the more nuances I understood about, you know, just acknowledging other people and letting people into allowing yourself to learn from others. And, you know, these things turned out to be much more rewarding to me over time.
But I mean, we should say you came later to that because, right, of this atmosphere and as you say, your dad's kind of self-performance than many of us would.
Yeah. So I, again, having grown up committed to a certain idea of how my life was supposed to play out, each time I went to college, you know, I would encounter some difficulty, some detour, roadblock, and not know how to negotiate it, not know how to handle it. And it wasn't until I was 26, in my mid-20s, I believe, that I really decided that I was going to go to school, go back to college, and study what I wanted to study and do it the way I found most rewarding. And of course, after that, you know, I was just successful, you know, academically successful the whole way through. But yeah, it took me a long time because I just believed so deeply in the role, the social roles that everyone is supposed to play. And well, this is just how it goes. And, you know, I'm being silly by thinking I could step out of these narratives. There's something naive about that. But no.
Gregory Pardlow is with us. If you've just gotten in on the show and you can hear the way the conversation is developing from this excellent memoir, it's called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. We've begun talking about how a family's identity and story of itself develops and the role that parents play in that and what happens when something traumatic. I use some examples here. The loss of a parent's job, which was what happened in Gregory Pardlow's family, the diagnosis perhaps of a serious illness, a parent who goes to prison, how that interrupts and interferes with the idea of who you are and what your family is. And I welcome some insight from you as you're listening to this. 651-227-6000 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Listener here says, this is going to be so hard to listen to this morning. They're still with us, Gregory, don't worry. But deep appreciation on the subject and sharing of these stories. And thanks to you, Gregory, for that. And to the phones to Joe in Forest Lake. Hi, Joe. Sounds like you have a story with this.
Oh, well, you mentioned, you know, disruptions when you're young. Okay, I'm 70, grew up in the 50s in a Catholic home. And my mother divorced my father when I was the oldest of five. It was between seventh and eighth grade. I remember going to eighth grade, you know, the product of a broken home. So it changed every single thing, you know, and
you thought of yourself. Did you think of yourself like that, Joe?
Yeah, I knew that was hanging over me, sure. You know, I mean, you talked about it in school, you know, how important it was to not divorce, how it affects the kids. And so, yeah, there I was. And I acted out. I got picked up for shoplifting, you know, a couple of years after that. And, you know, my life could have gone really, really, really bad. And it did, you know, we talk about it. You know, when we get together, we're kind of scattered all over the country. We don't see each other, you know, once a year. You know, I try to get to see everybody, but it affected everybody. It affects, it social things. I didn't date in school, basically not at all.
You know, Joe, I really appreciate the call. I want to pick up on something that you were saying there. And Gregory, I think you had some experience with this. You know, outside expectations looking in, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is how we see your family, and now you're going through this, and now this is how we understand who you are. And right. Now that filters right down to, like, your experience at school.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's a way that we're not only do we have the stories that we tell ourselves, but when we are open to, particularly at young age, we are open to people telling us what our stories are. Right. And, you know, and we're looking for a way to belong in this, in whatever community, however we define our communities. And yeah, when I was after the strike, there was a, you know, your family, your father's never going to work again, right? This is what a teacher told me. And the lesson that I got out of that was that, you know, we were outcasts. We were, you know, sort of alienated from society. And I saw myself, I understood myself as that for a very long time. So yeah, I hear what Joe's saying.
Dante called to say, in 2003, my wife was diagnosed with lupus. She just had a kidney transplant where I donated the kidney. It's definitely reshaped our family. It looked like it was unraveling. At this point, we're stronger than ever. And to Jeffrey in Stillwater. Hey, Jeffrey. Hi.
How are you?
Doing well. I'm glad you called. What's your? Sounds like you have some experience with this.
Well, when I was 11 years old, my mother died on February 14th, and it completely changed my world. And it woke me up to what the world is capable of, and then feeling like, oh, all of my friends have mothers and I don't. And then what's the role of my father in taking care of me? And I saw him in a completely new way because he needed to be mother and father at the same time. And it changed the family structure incredibly.
Jeffrey, if I may, I am struck by that phrase you use, what the world is capable of. Do you mean that it's a cruel world, and at 11 years old you learn that?
Oh, yeah. That's right. I mean, something so unimaginable, catastrophic to the psyche of an 11-year-old means that the world can do this to me, and in my ideal youthfulness, I never would have imagined that was possible. Mm-hmm.
Gregory, does that resonate at all?
Sure, yeah, yeah. And there is something naive and necessary, I think, in a positive way, about the way we believe that we are protected as kids, and particularly at, he says, 11 years old, right? We're right around puberty, I think.
Right.
It's really vulnerable to... you know, your body is going through changes, and to have such a life changing occurrence, we can take it as if the world is doing this to me, right? And we have ourselves at the center of the universe, and yeah, it takes some doing to rethink, to realign yourself in relation to the idea of victimhood, you know, and how pervasive and how much that can linger with one and play out in all kinds of different ways in one's life.
For listeners here, the title Air Traffic comes, well, from a number of different ideas at the center of the memoir, but specifically it comes from Gregory Pardlow's father was an air traffic controller. They went on strike. Ronald Reagan, who was president in 1981, fired the strikers. And Gregory, I went back to listen to a little bit of what Reagan said that day, and we've got a little clip from that just to kind of orient us in this history. Let's listen.
Let me make one thing plain. I respect the right of workers in the private sector to strike. Indeed, as president of my own union, I led the first strike ever called by that union. I guess I'm maybe the first one to ever hold this office who is a lifetime member of an AFL-CIO union. But we cannot compare labor-management relations in the private sector with government. Government cannot close down the assembly line. It has to provide without interruption the protective services which are government's reason for being.
What do you remember your dad saying about that argument that Reagan was making?
Well, that he was essentially saying that this sector had no right to collective bargaining. And, you know, as an adult, I find myself understanding it's an obvious argument that the government can't shut down. And I agree with that completely. But as a kid, the idea that because you work for the government, you are beholden in a way that you don't have options, there's a kind of lack of agency in that relationship. I found that very, very frustrating. And it was also this undercurrent that the controllers didn't really want to strike, right? That there was all a kind of braggadocio. There was a kind of chest pounding performance. And these characters, the president on the one hand and the union on the other, found themselves slipping into roles that they didn't necessarily want to play, but they were, you know, they were just on this collision course, which actually is the title of one of the kind of most important books about the strike. So the logic is all there, the reasoning is all there. But we don't always operate based on, you know, the logic of, you know, some larger ethos.
You know, it's well said, because when you go back, as I did, to read a little in depth about how this evolved and why Reagan got to this point, you get this sense that it wasn't written from the beginning, that this is how, you know, this would play out. I mean, there is this sense that people know they're coming to a precipice, and there is, can we ravel this back, right? Can we step back from the cliff of this, which makes this all the more tragic, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Which is what caught everyone by surprise. And you know, as I write in the book, there was, I remember going to the Union Hall and hearing the men joke days before the strike even was announced. You know, what are they going to do? Fire us all? Right? It was just the most absurd thing. And, you know, there was a history of sort of work slowdowns and you know, other various techniques of exerting some collective will on the part of the union. And even that, they weren't all committed to the idea of calling themselves a union, right? And they wanted to be known as a professional organization. And so they're just the identity and the role that they play in the narrative that gets placed on, you know, this sort of narrative template that gets overlaid on the situation. I don't think anyone was really prepared to follow that particular script out.
There's something I didn't want to miss in this. I was curious about whether your dad had a combination of pretty unique skills that made him so good at being an air traffic controller. Is that true? And what were those skills?
Yeah, I think so. His he had a very disciplined mind, and as we said earlier, he could be singularly focused, and that is an absolute strength as an air traffic controller. One has to be focused to the point of not allowing any doubts or suspicions or self-doubts even enter into your thinking as you're giving these orders to move the planes around throughout the sky. But that requires an awful lot of ego. And you know, you look at across the workforce of the air traffic controllers, you replicate that personality type over and over again, and you have you know, this workforce that doesn't really know, isn't really prepared for you know, for diplomacy. Right there, you know, you have to be in charge of the orders that you're given.
Okay, so that's why the ego. That's why you say this is a profession that really requires a strong ego, because what you hold this delicate balance in your hand every minute to minute.
That's right. Yeah.
And you believe you've got the ability and the skills to make it work.
That's right. Wow. Yeah.
Gregory Pardlow's memoir is called Air Traffic, A Memoir of Ambition and Manhood in America. There's a tweet here, Gregory, that I wanted to share with you, and I think it's interesting for where we're going on masculinity. Roseanne tweeted, "I know there is trauma, and then there's trauma coupled with shame. They're both hard, but one is infinitely harder than the other." And I wondered, as we talk about masculinity, whether your father's expression of this overpowering masculinity was in some ways a compensation for some of the shame he felt after the air traffic controller strike firing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So his running into the reality, facing the reality of having been fired, you know, there was a lingering period of a few months, in fact, where we continued as a family to believe, well, any minute now the controllers are going to be invited back to work, right? This whole thing will just kind of evaporate, and we'll have, our lives will go back to normal. But as it dawned on all of us, I could see it in my father as he very grudgingly started picking up part-time jobs, you know, with not having an option. And his self-image was still the guy in the control tower that could hold all of these very delicate lives in the air in balance, and then, you know, being forced into demoted, as he saw it, to work as a security guard, you know, which in any other context is a perfectly legitimate job. But because of the story that he told, because of his sense of masculinity, anything else was embarrassing, was shameful for him. And so over time, that shame compounds, you know, and he has to compensate in more and more creative ways.
And just to be clear here, this is not just a father whose idea of masculinity is tied to being a provider. I mean, it really is about the unique capability that he had to do this high risk, high stakes kind of work.
That's right. Yeah. So you think about, people often ask me, well, where did he go to work after that? As if, you know, one could just, you know,
pick up and
take a job somewhere else. Not only the government has a monopoly on air traffic control on those jobs. He was not trained to, he was specially trained to do nothing other than that job. And so, you know, unless he were willing to move us all to Kuwait, for example, there was no option of doing this. So the two things that happened, one is because he is so uniquely trained, he sees himself as a kind of unicorn, right? He's so uniquely valuable that that anything else is beneath him. And the other side is that he's unable to then, you know, adjust to the circumstances when that job is taken away from him.
Interesting tweet on this from a listener who says, just a thought, wondering if former surgeons have similar stories to Mr. Pardlow's father. Mm. It's a good point, right?
That's a great question. Yeah. And in fact, I had a very brief interaction with someone who said that her father was a surgeon and dealt with the stress of, you know, having someone's life literally at your fingertips, and how that stress played itself out at home. I guess the one difference is if you lose your medical license, then that would be a kind of a similar situation. But
having the work denied to you.
The way the story went, you know, it's like he's standing outside of the my image is us standing outside of the airport at the fence, you know, sort of looking in and thinking, that's our life. That's, you know, that's our, and I very much saw myself as a part of that, that whole narrative of masculinity and provider and master of the universe, all of those stories wrapped up in there. Mm-hmm.
Jackie says on Twitter, both my parents lost their jobs in the FAA strike, changing our lives drastically, ultimately for the better. Want that perspective shared, the bright end of a traumatic event. We've done a number of shows, as I mentioned, on contemporary masculinity and really trying to understand, you know, what this country sees as its standard of good masculinity. And I think a number of our guests have said we're in this moment where the country feels chaotic in some ways, even though the economy doesn't for some people. And that is a time when we tend to go back to a traditional ideal of masculinity. And I'm interested, given how much you've thought about this, what you think about it.
Yeah. So again, so much of the book is me thinking through and confronting the stories that I had been given growing up. And I, absolutely. We're in a moment when, you know, and I find myself every time I try and think, well, maybe if I just, you know, adjust the story of masculinity a little bit in this way, I can see another sort of domino on the other side fall over, and it's so, or I'd probably House of Cards is a better metaphor. It's such a delicate construction that I think it's important just to knock the whole thing down and rethink it all together.
Okay, tell me why.
So, because it is so connected to so many other, and you know, I can hear my father now in the back of my head, you know, pointing out the idealism and the naivete of that. You know, I don't actually believe that you know, we can sort of wake up and just, you know, wipe the table clean and start over rebuilding our idea of masculinity. But I think there is we are in it. The opportunity in this is that we do know that masculinity, as we've constructed it, is not working, and in fact is harmful to a great many people, not only women but children and, you know, people who have fewer resources and so on and so forth. That the idea of the patriarch dominating, you know, and I think domination is the kind of key characteristic in there that I want to challenge. And yeah, there's an opportunity to rethink it altogether. But the difficulty is that so many of us are still invested in the story of masculinity as being, you know, domineering.
Right, because we're steeped in that from the time. It's so hard. I mean, I might agree with your father about the idealism. Mm-hmm. How do we wipe that clean?
So what I'm trying to do, one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is sort of provocatively suggest that this can be done on an individual level. Uh-huh. And, you know, not only with masculinity, but with the concept of race, you know, and so we become so committed to these narratives about who we are that we think that, well, if I'm not performing masculinity in this particular way, then I'm somehow, insulting or disavowing, rejecting my father and grandfather and great grandfather, so on. But I want to inject into the conversation the possibility that we all might collectively sort of rethink about the logic of having these stories. Yeah. if we can come together as a union, right? And I think that's the central metaphor of the book. If we can come together as a union to act collectively toward a certain goal, then it should be possible, I guess is the argument that I'm making, that we can rethink our cultural union, our social union and political union in a way that allows for new narratives of about masculinity and identity in general.
You know, I think that you believe, as a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, that poetry has a role to play in that.
I do.
You say, I'm a poet. It makes you a nicer person. Poetry and civic duty share a porous border in my mind. Poetry plays a role in this collective union?
It does. And I have seen it, seen the work that poetry can do. You were talking about education earlier in the hour, and I do think that I have so many students come into my classroom and sit in front of a poem and say, "Oh, this doesn't make any sense to me. This is, you know, ridiculous." And once we get into a conversation about what's happening in the poem and what is being suggested beyond the poem, right? We're so we tend to believe that the poem is simply the words on the page. And once we begin to invest the poem with our own imagination and think about the world that the poem is suggesting beyond the words on the page, then there's an entirely different relationship. And I think that model taken out into the world, as we begin to interact with one another, or as we interact with one another, if we're practiced in seeing more than, you know, the surface of each other, and we imagine and understand and respect the larger story that everyone carries with them, then that's a fundamentally different world, different society.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. I just had a conversation with Tracy K. Smith about this, and you know, she's been traveling as the poet laureate and going to some places that I don't know, poets don't necessarily show up to for readings. And I wanted you to hear a little bit of that conversation. So here it is.
Great. Mm.
Now I feel that poetry, you know, it still carries me in a musical, energetic, and visceral way, but it also offers me so many different ways of looking at the world that I live in, looking at small details that can yield profound kinds of insights. Poems give me a vocabulary, a borrowed vocabulary, for some of the most powerful and indescribable feelings or experiences that I've had. And I think that makes me better equipped to move forward in the world. Mm. It makes me more comfortable thinking about what's difficult. It makes me more eager to see the familiar world in a new way, which is refreshing.
I really liked the idea of a new vocabulary coming to explain this. What does that say to you?
Well, it's probably much better put the very ideas that I'm trying to articulate. And I, you know, Tracy's a dear friend, and I we've had this conversation, and I think it's common among poetry lovers that the tools that we bring to the page end up being the tools that we bring to the world, right? As we begin to see the world, and it's not just the vocabulary, the technical vocabulary, right? Mm-hmm. Just having more words. It's having more strategies for understanding the world.
Your mother helped to run a jazz club, right? The Serengeti for some time.
That's right.
I wanted to close with some jazz, and I chose John Coltrane from the album Blue Train. Does music, in the way that poetry that you've just described, also give you a kind of vocabulary, a new way of understanding what's happening around us?
You know, and this is one of those conversations that poets sit around having, particularly in poets and musicians. I think music gives us new ways of feeling, of new ways of thinking and processing internally. But I'm not sure that music gives us new tools for engaging the outside world.
Okay. Why? Because it's a pretty interior experience?
Because it's an interior experience. And you know, I am a huge advocate of the arts in general. I think the art, any art, gives us a way of thinking and processing that we don't get from more kind of vocational experience with the world. But I think that the benefits of poetry and music are not entirely the same. Of course, there are overlaps, but they're equipping us to think in different ways about the world. And I think I wouldn't want to collapse them as simply this, you know, doing the same work. I think they're both necessary, but in unique ways.
Gregory, I am really grateful that you spent an hour with us today. I know you've talked a lot about this memoir. I'm just I'm really happy to have you and to have done this. Thank you.
Oh, it's been great to talk to you, Carrie. Thanks for having me so much.
Gregory Pardlow's memoir is called Air Traffic, a memoir of ambition and manhood in America. Okay, I've been hearing from a lot of you about the shows on politics that we've done this week. On Monday, we talked about what Midwestern Trump voters are saying now. We talked with Dan Balls about that. And then yesterday, we talked about all this chaos and the scrambling going on in the DFL. So I've heard from a lot of you. I've pulled just a few of the letters. Feel free to send me what you think of the shows. Kevin emailed in to say a huge thank you to Pat for her feedback. And Pat was a listener who called in to say, as a Christian evangelical voter, I broke away from Trump. I couldn't support him. And she gave us her thoughts about that. Kevin says, I, too, am an evangelical Christian, and I feel marginalized by many fellow Christians when they know that I'm not a Trump supporter because I, too, lead with my faith and could never vote for somebody like him. Unfortunately, I think both parties polarize the issues without focusing on consensus and the middle, where I believe most Americans are. Nikki wrote in to say about the Trump voter conversation, Carrie, every time I hear conversations about what Trump voters and Republicans believe, I can't help but see the logical disconnect between what they say they don't care about Trump's behavior as long as he gets results. Bill Clinton got results in our economy, but they sure didn't give him a pass. In general, I hear many of them saying they won't vote for politicians that support abortion, gay rights, or immigrant rights based on moral values. Yet again, they give Trump's vulgar behavior a pass. Here's Patricia, who wrote in after listening to the Trump voter conversation. I've never contacted you before. I listened to your piece about Trump voters yesterday and agreed with the caller who wondered why there is so much continuing focus on Trump voters and almost no journalistic interest in those of us who did not vote for Trump. And then she goes on to give me a number of points, including your speaker described Trump voters as believing those of us who do not like Trump are hateful towards them. I respectfully disagree. There is a wide gulf of partisanship in this country, but I experience most of the hate as coming from one side. In fact, as never before, I feel demeaned, even despised by continuous attacks. Example, urban elite. I live in St. Paul. From national and state GOP legislators and leaders and their followers. And I heard from Nick about our social agenda. I think there was a conversation about social agendas in a couple of the political conversations we had. And Nick wrote in to say, I often hear the adage that Democrats have a social agenda. While that may be the case in some ways, what irritates me is this idea that Republicans don't also have a social agenda. It might be more opaque or more about existing culturally entrenched ideas. Our cultural blinders might obscure that more on the Republican side. I believe all politics has sociological and all politics has psychological aims. Thank you. Keep listening and keep letting me know what you think.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.